This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So, you've heard of the gender pay gap, but what about the gender health gap? Medical research is mostly carried out on male cells and male animals, and early stage clinical trials are conducted mostly on men. So why aren't women represented equally in medical research? And how does that gender bias affect the health outcome of women? Our mums, our sisters, our aunties, our wives and our friends. Good morning, I'm Rochelle Hunt, your co-host this morning, Bronwyn O'Shea, joining you from ABC Wodonga. Bron, when we talk about gender health bias, this even extends to the crash test dummy.
I know. Who would have thought? I'd never even considered this, but I just learnt recently that crash test dummies are based on male anatomy. So, of course, that then means car safety features are designed for men, and that leaves women much more vulnerable, you know, more likely to be injured or killed in a crash. They do have a female crash test dummy, though. Guess when it was designed and released?
I don't even want to guess because I feel like it's not going to be a good date.
2 years ago, 2022, was the very first female crash test dummy.
Oh, my goodness.
And that it's not just a problem on the research end either. I mean, there was that survey that we heard about last week from the National Women's Health Advisory Council where over 70% of women say that they'd experienced gender bias or discrimination in the healthcare system. And, you know, we only hear that story today in ABC News about women wanting and asking for pain relief during birth and not receiving it.
When we talk about things like endometriosis, people not being believed, let alone being able to access treatment, there we are taking baby steps when it comes to understanding, recognising and believing women's health, but there is still a long way to go. But today you are going to meet some incredible people that are ensuring that we not only keep this conversation going, but we make some big, big changes. So maybe you work in the field of medicine. How would you like to see the gender bias change? Or maybe as a patient, have you not been believed? Have you experienced gender bias?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt in Melbourne, Bronwyn O'Shea joining you from ABC Wodonga. As we look at gender bias in our healthcare system, from pain relief during childbirth, endometriosis, simply not being believed when you go and speak to a doctor, maybe something just being fobbed off as women's issues. How far have we come and how far do we need to go? Well, next week, a new virtual centre is going to open. It's got the aim of eliminating gender discrimination in the health centre. It's called the Centre for Sex and Gender Equity in Health and Medicine. And it's an incredible collaboration. It's between Deakin University. It's also between the George Institute of Global Health and the Australian Human Rights Institute. Professor Rachel Huxley is the Executive Dean of the Faculty of Health at Deakin and is leading Deakin's involvement in this new centre. Professor, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour. When we talk about gender bias in health, I knew it wasn't great, but I had no idea just how bad it was. When we talk about medical research, clinical trials, is anything done through the lens of a woman?
Oh, that is an excellent question. And I would have to say that no. I think that the fact is that women are underrepresented in the trials that we do, in the studies that we do. They often have the suboptimal treatment outcomes when they present with a complaint. They're often not believed or they're misdiagnosed. Which can have some really terrible outcomes. But I think that the question is, though, how much don't we know? I think we're only at the tip of the iceberg in terms of actually really understanding, beginning to understand the extent of sex and gender bias in our health and medical system. And thinking about how the work that we do in training the next generation
Yes.
of health practitioners, because this is not just a medical issue. It's not just doctors, it's pervasive across nursing, allied health groups. We did some really interesting work a while ago, which looked at how men and women who presented to an emergency department in Victoria, so we took three big hospitals, and we looked to see what happened to individuals who presented with what's called non-traumatic chest pain. Mm-hmm. So close to something resembling a heart attack. And what we found was that as soon as people entered the emergency department doors, women received less optimal care from point A through to Z. There were, took a longer time for them to be seen by a specialist. They were less likely to receive the right test to diagnose a heart condition, less likely to be admitted to a coronary care or an intensive care unit, and they had higher mortality rates after 28 days. And what's interesting, though, is that when you look at the medical workforce in the hospitals, about 90% of nurses are women.
That's what I think is so strange. So why do you think that's the case? Why are women screened and treated so differently to men in that situation?
Look, I think I'm guessing here because we need to find out. This is part of the work of the centre. But I would imagine it's got something to do with how we teach about disease presentation from as soon as the students come through the doors. If I think about the textbooks I learned from 30-odd years ago now, it was classic, you know, male presentation with a heart attack. It was, you know, what does somebody having a heart attack look like? And it's somebody typically a white male in his 60s clutching his heart. And that's, it's still pervasive. You look at the media, if you look at recent movies or films that you've seen where somebody's had a heart attack on the screen, for example, let's reflect back and think.
But when we think about gender bias and how the world operates and all of the solutions that we've put into place, not just in the medical world, it's done through a male lens on the temperature of this office, for example, is done to, I think, a man that is on average age 25 to 30 years old. Who wears a suit. The height of where you put you hold your arm rail on a train or a tram is designed for a man of that same age. Our cities and our worlds are actually designed, whether we like it or not, and this is not about man bashing, this is just fact, mm-hmm. are designed for a man of a certain age. In order for that to change and filter through to the medical world, that's got to start right at the very beginning, doesn't it? I mean, that needs to start at med school. What chance have we got?
Well, I think it has to start earlier than that. I think it actually has to start in kindy. I think by the time they come into university, it's a bit late. So thinking about gender playing, do we still, when we have girls and boys in kindergarten, for example, do we still divert the boys to the Lego bricks and the trucks and the girls to the playhouses and the dolls, reinforcing the caring aspects of traditional female and the building creative roles for men. And I think if you look at engineering, which is a very male-dominated space, it's not a surprise that when you look outside in the environment, that it is very gendered. It is a male perspective. So until we have equality in an equal representation of individuals in the workforce, particularly in the historically male-dominated professions, then we're not going to see much change yet.
Let's have a chat to Susanna, who's called in from Mont Albert. Hi, Susanna.
Hello, thank you. Yes, I responded to the call. I had an experience at a hospital with a male doctor, and my husband and I had the experience of our second child being stillborn, and it was of course a very traumatic time, and we went back to the hospital for the autopsy results, and I went in there with a printed list of questions. Despite it being so traumatic, I took the approach, and I think other women would relate to this, of really trying to be polite and non-confrontational and not aggressive and not emotional even, in the hope that he would be open with me, that the doctor would be open to a discussion and that I would get some level of information. And I when I look back, I can't believe the response, because he was so dismissive. And one of the first comments he made to me was, well, babies die in Africa all the time. And that then when I asked him a question, which was about, do we need to be worried that this could happen again if we try to have another baby? And he said to me, and it was said in such a condescending way, well, I think you need to try again to land the plane successfully. And I look back and I couldn't believe it. But honestly, at the time, I accepted it. And I remember leaving that meeting saying, oh, well, I think that was okay. And I look back and I think, no, that's not okay. But I think, I don't know, as a woman,
it's
feel like...
It's not okay.
It's really not okay. It was so far from okay. And he refused to look at my questions. He refused to discuss them in any way. And he ended up, in fact, leaving the meeting after about 10 minutes.
Oh, Susanna, I'm so sorry that you and your husband have been through that. What's interesting, stay with us, Susanna. Rachel, when we talk about advocating for ourselves, and Susanna, because you're in trauma, right, Susanna? You've just been through one of the most horrific things that a person can experience, and that is the loss of a child. You're in a traumatic state. So, and even though you're really organised and you've gone in there with a list of questions and all sorts of things, you don't know at the time how to advocate for yourself. Is that something that you experience? And we heard in the news today, in particular when it comes to childbirth and women being able to advocate for pain relief, the sort of pain relief they want and when they want it. How do you know when to stand up for yourself and when to maybe say this is not acceptable?
I think, Susanna, if I can just say, I think I'm deeply sorry for your loss. I mean, that is... any woman to experience the loss of a child is just incredibly sad, and I hope that you have received the support and the care subsequent to the atrocious treatment that you received. Now there are some terrific groups around the country who provide support for women and families who've experienced the loss of a child, and I do hope you've accessed them. Agency and empowering patients and consumers and women and to find their voice when they're seeking help, because seeking help is actually quite I think women don't take it lightly. If there's something wrong, they go and they. I think we're often seen as they don't want to create a fuss. We don't want to make a fuss. And I still think there's sort of the good doctor mentality that the doctor knows best, and that I'm not going to push back. But there are a number of consumer advocacy groups now who are working in support of essentially empowering individuals to challenge and push back, and if they're not getting the right treatment or the care in the first instance, to go back and to question until they do get the outcome they need and resolution they need. But I think part of this is about, again, it comes back to how we train our healthcare professionals. And at Deakin we have a center for which is all around communication, clinical communication, because it's an art form. Teaching clinicians how to communicate with their...
That's a whole other show, almost, isn't it, really? The sort of language used, the tone used, whether or not you know, Susanna, you would have felt, whether or not you felt like... You know when you know someone's not actually listening to you and you're like, you're not hearing what I'm saying, but then at the same time, Rachel, as you said, you'd probably be thinking, Susanna, well, what do I know, right? And what rights do I have to maybe ask to see somebody else?
Exactly. Yeah. Even when he left the meeting, I didn't say anything, and I think there is this feeling of, I don't want to be the hysterical woman or the difficult woman. I want them to see me as reasonable and, I don't know, a nice person, and then they'll help me, and that is not my experience.
Oh, Susanna, the amount of love that's come in for you on the text line is huge, and we really appreciate your call. And as Rachel said, we really hope that you're getting the care that you need. Thank you for sharing your story. Margaret's in Surry Hills.
For decades, I have remarked at therapists and medicos' rooms that their physiology and anatomy charts are male. And they say, oh, yes, in quite some terms of surprise, but nothing changes.
And so all of the posters and everything that you see are always looking at the male anatomy as well. Tell us about the centre. What are you hoping to change? This is a virtual centre, which I think is incredible, because I know, Bron, we talk about access to healthcare for our regional and rural listeners all the time. And when you're in, when you're not outside, or when you are outside the CBD of Melbourne, getting access to health is really difficult sometimes. So the fact that this is virtual, how is this going to shift the dial of some of the things that we're hearing about?
Well, I think the purpose, there are many objectives of the centre, and I think the first one is really about raising general awareness about the existence of sex and gender bias in the health system as it exists. We want to take a multi-pronged approach to try and tackle some of the problems. It's around research, it's around teaching and education, it's around advocacy and lobbying for equal rights and equal access. I think you pick up on the issue of health disparities in access to care in communities living in regional and rural parts of the country. This is very much a part of Deakin's bread and butter, our DNA. It's to improve health outcomes in our communities in Western Victoria. I mean, if you look at the data on some health outcomes, for example, if you look at breast cancer and mastectomies, women with breast cancer are far more likely to have a mastectomy if they live in a rural, regional area of Victoria compared to women who live in metro Melbourne, because those living closer to the cancer treatment centres can undergo the chemotherapy and the radiotherapy. They don't need to have the radical surgery. Whereas if you're in 3 or 4 hours' drive away, you have little choice. Mm. And so that's just a very concrete example of how geographical disparities can play out. So the centre, yes, it's virtual in the first instance. Ideally, it'd be fantastic in 5-10 years to have a beaming, glowing, shiny new building. But in the first instance, it's very much driven around people and capability and capacity. And the work that we're going to be doing here at Deakin is really going to be leading the conversation around curriculum, redesign, reform, and advocacy and policy making. How do we ensure that our funding agencies, for example, which provide funding, health and medical research funding, how do we embed...
Yeah, what do they ask? So if you're receiving funding from someone, because I know a lot of the work that is being done for this centre in particular is philanthropic, but that's a lot of the case when it comes to things like clinical trials. So how do you then say, well, yes, but we want to ensure that there is some kind of gender balance, or at least shift the dial a little bit when it comes to this particular research?
Great question. I mean, we're far behind in Australia compared to other countries. So Canada is leading the way in this. They've been pioneers in this space the last 10 years, and we've been fortunate enough to be able to borrow from their expertise, so we can shorten that 10-year window to hopefully an 18-month. But what's required is a legislated component in research that mandates that if you're going to get government funded public funds, then you need to ensure that the studies that you do have a equal representation from gender diverse groups. And we're not just talking women and men here, but there's a significant group of the population who don't identify as binary. And we think there's disparities between how women and men access treatment, then I think if we were to look in the transgender and intersex and the non-binary groups, then we're at very much ground zero, I think, in terms of how we address the health issues that they face.
Professor Rachel Huxley is who we're speaking with. She's the Executive Dean of the Faculty of Health at Deakin University and leading Deakin's involvement in this new virtual centre that we're hearing about, which is the Centre for Sex and Gender Equity in Health and Medicine, a collaboration between Deakin, the George Institute of Global Health and the Australian Human Rights Institute. Here on The Conversation, as we're talking about the bias, the gender bias that exists in health and medicine, and if that's something that you've experienced, we'd love to hear from you.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you, and Melbourne Bronwyn O'Shea joining you from ABC Wodonga. And in the studio, Professor Rachel Huxley, Executive Dean of the Faculty of Health at Deakin University, who is leading Deakin's involvement in a new centre which is being opened to look at gender bias in health. It's called the Centre for Sex and Gender Equity in Health and Medicine. Dolores has been waiting patiently in Melbourne.
Well, I've been listening to what you're saying about gender bias against women. I wasn't born in Australia nor educated here, but we have to start from the home. I find that the first female graduate for chemical engineering in Melbourne University was in 1977, and I nearly fainted when I heard it because I was doing the same degree in 1964 in the University of the Philippines. So really, in Australian women, I find, have been relegated to becoming nurses or secretaries or teachers in my age group. And of course, there are those who went into science. So I think it is not just you start at kindergarten or you start at high school or you start in medical school. It has to start from the home. The women in the home have to be treated equally as the men. I actually know someone in my husband's family whose father told her, and she was the older child, you now have to go and go on your own way. I put you through private school. I will only send your brother to university. I won't be sending you, because this was in the days when people did not get paid. So I think that we have to talk about our home.
Yeah.
Rachel, I wonder, does just the presence of more women working in medical research and having more female doctors, does that start to have an influence on this gender bias that we're talking about today?
I think it helps. We are now at the point where we have more than, I think, 51% of all medical graduates are women. But what happens as life progresses and life gets more complicated, the level of seniority of women...
That's
in
it, they're not progressing into becoming the oncologists and the surgeons. They're potentially going part-time and staying where they started.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting when you look at nursing as well. When we have one of the largest nursing midwifery schools in the country, about 90% of our students, our 3,000 students each year, are women. But when you look at senior nursing management in Australia, you could almost flip that. It's very overrepresented by men. So there is something that we need to be doing in the workforce. I actually think it's around trying to encourage more men, more boys and men, into workforce, into the sort of the traditional caring responsibilities. But until we increase the salaries, and that's not going to happen.
Dr. Nicole Higgins is the president of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners and has not only been listening to a lot of this, but has also been campaigning very hard for changes when it comes to gender bias herself. Nicole, a warm welcome back to the Conversation Hour. How far behind or how far ahead are we moving at the moment? It does feel like the conversation has started. We'll talk about endometriosis a little later in the program, but it wasn't that long ago. The word endometriosis wasn't even discussed, let alone it's something that is believed and centres are being opened. Are you seeing any progression when it comes to the bias?
Yeah, good morning. It is a really important discussion to have, because there is an assumption that a lot of this has been addressed by our decision makers, and it hasn't. So I'm a GP, female GP. I'm also a leader of my organisation, which has 40,000 members. And as Rachel said, we now have 51% of our medical graduates as you know, coming through are women. For GPs, we now have 2/3 of our GPs in training are women. So they bring that lived experience of what it's like to be treated through the health system. And that change is starting to come through, but it is going to take time. Yesterday, I'm in Canberra at the moment, and I was at a meeting, and one of the decision makers actually blamed, you know, effectively women for the workforce issues. And instead of actually saying, we will support women to be able to work more hours or support men to be able to stay home, you know, it was our fault because people aren't working as many hours that they once were. So it's still there.
Let's head to Sandra at Altona Meadows. Welcome to the Conversation Hour, Sandra. What did you want to say?
Thank you. I just wanted to ask a question of the researcher as to whether intersectionality plays any part or understanding in the research. And particularly, I can only speak about my mother and age and the concept of becoming more invisible as you get older a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found that she gets fobbed off sometimes in dealing with her medical issues. She's 88. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you've got any comments
on... Age is a big part of it, isn't it? Nicole, stay with us because I would like to get your comment on this as well. I know when my mum was going through treatment, I would go with my mum to all the appointments because it was overwhelming, and so I'd sit there with her because sometimes you need two ears.
Mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't look at my mum sometimes. They would talk to me like she wasn't in the room, and she wasn't even that old. But like with Sandra's mum, who's 88, do you have ageism and gender bias combined together?
Absolutely. You know, I think on our society and how anti-ageist it is. You know, you think about the beauty industry in Australia, the billions of dollars of money that women pour into treatments to stop or reverse the aging process, because somehow it has a negative connotation on in terms of a woman's currency.
Mm.
Nobody wants to admit getting older, and this is part of the issue, I think, around dealing with the stigma around menopause, for example. Nobody talks about that in the workplace, and yet half of the population experiences it at some point, but we don't talk
That's
about
something
it.
Something else where we're just starting to shift the dial and start the conversation.
Nicole Higgins is with us, President of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. What do you hope might change, and what role do us as patients potentially play in this too when we go and speak with our GPs, Nicole?
So we've raised the comments already around ageism and sexism and the challenges that for those who are rural and for women of colour. It's a really challenging conversation, but women need to be able to be heard. And we're now getting more and more female GPs who deal with much more complex problems than our male counterparts. We deal with more mental health. We actually spend longer with the person who's sitting in front of us. And so I think we're actually changing the way medicine is delivered or general practice is in Australia. But we also need to be able to increase the health literacy and to enable mm-hmm. women to be able to advocate as well for themselves. And that's part of this conversation, because we know, as been alluded to, research has been done on men's bodies. How women present and are treated with chest pain will be different mm-hmm. to if it's a male counterpart. So we're educating our members and also having that conversation with our male and female GPs so that they can reflect mm-hmm. and address their own
bias. And there are a lot of texts, aren't there, Rochelle, coming yep. through from women who've had chest pain and gone mm-hmm. on to have heart attacks, who are talking exactly about this challenge of not either being dismissed or not really being heard and mm-hmm. addressed properly. There's a really interesting message here from Deb in Bentley East, and she says, my birthday's on International Women's Day, so I always hear plenty of discussion of women's issues. It only just occurred to me this year, she says, as a menopausal woman using HRT, my medications, estrogen, progesterone and testosterone, are not on the PBS. Mm-hmm. How are women who experience symptoms from going through menopause supposed to stay sane and stay in the workforce when essential meds are not supported? So that's a, I mean, I know that's a whole other section
of
the conversation. You know, the cost as well being not equal for women.
I think we need a female prime minister back.
We've just come out of the Women's Health Advisory Council, and this was one of the biggest issues. Why should women be having to pay more for contraception, for IUDs, for treatment for peri and menopausal therapies? And why isn't the government supporting it? And there has not been a clear answer given back. It's just is. So we do need to change that as a matter of emergency.
But look, we put tax on sanitary items, you know, like periods are a luxury. So where do we begin with that? If there was one major thing, I mean, does this come from, just finally, Nicole, does this come from governmental change? I mean, you've got incredible work that's being done by Rachel and her colleagues that are setting up this centre. In just a moment, we're going to speak to an endometriosis centre that's opened up in conjunction with the Epworth. So you've got private money out there and passionate people who are working together. Is that actually where you think change will occur, Nicole?
It's multi-level change, and it has, you know, there's this saying that fish rots from the top. It has to start at the top, and unless we change the legislation, the regulations to enable women's treatments to be supported, so whether that be medications or investigations or treatments, that's something that can be done very easily from the top. But it needs to also come from the ground as well, and that is by educating women to actually have health literacy, to actually understand what we're enabled to do, but also putting money into research and bringing on our health consumers and advocates as well to be able to make sure that women's voice is heard at every level of decision making.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's a really important point. But I'd also think that there's a role for men in this. They should be the ones supporting and assisting their partners. And I'm thinking particularly of culturally and linguistically diverse groups, where there may be more barriers for women to actually put their hand up and say, I need to see a doctor. And often they're unable to see a doctor on their own. They have to have a male relative with them when they see. So I think there are some quite significant barriers. And one of the progress steps we've made now in Australian research is that the use of consumers, those with lived experience, it's incredibly difficult, quite rightly so, it's incredibly difficult to get any funding from a government source, so the NHMRC, for example, or MOFF, unless you have strong consumer engagement and those with lived experience. So we want to do co-design research. We want to understand the issue from the consumer's perspective and really embed the consumer voice through all the work that we do. Because unless we have that, then we're going to keep missing the mark.
Dr. Nicole Higgins, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure, thank you.
President of the Australian College of General Practitioners. Lots of texts coming in on prolapse and people just not understanding prolapse or even recognising it. I belong to a few Facebook groups about prolapse in women. I believe it's yet another huge hidden issue which has been poorly researched, and remedies are confusing, they're ineffective, and they're just all over the place. It's a hidden disability. Wendy is in Reservoir. Morning, Wendy.
Morning, how are you?
Really well. What did you want to say?
I have, a complex health condition. I've only recently found out, I've lived with pain. Instead of saying I've lived with pain since childhood, and I'm in my mid-60s now, and I have been through the medical system for many decades, and I just like, I mean, I think it's wonderful that the focus is on the fact that women of culturally diverse and maybe rural backgrounds have obstacles. But I live in Melbourne. I had to teach myself more about the medical system and also basically self-diagnose and then try and find a medical practitioner who will actually listen to me. Now, when I went to a pain specialist a few years back to talk about myalgia encephalomyelitis, otherwise known as chronic fatigue syndrome, When I walked into the room, I was told that if I mentioned that acronym in that room while he was there, he would immediately ask me to leave the room. When I said that I'd lived with pain all my life, I said I was on crutches at the age of 14 because of pain, and he said that's impossible because if I had, and I said I had a blood circulation disorder, he said if you had that, you would have had a limb amputated by now.
I think recognizing pain and understanding $700
for this. And there's apart from myalgia and encephalomyelitis, which in ancient Greek actually means muscle pain and inflammation of the brain, it's not just fatigue. I've since then diagnosed myself with POTS.
I think you're just raising so many important issues there, Wendy. I mean, one, we've done so many incredible programs actually on chronic fatigue and what that does to people and not being understood and not being believed and the emotion that that takes with it. One thing that Wendy has said a few times there, Professor, is self-diagnosis. How problematic is that if you feel like the only option you've got left is to diagnose it yourself?
It's a huge problem. The amount of misinformation out there, I think we've all been tempted to do a
Dr. Google,
and you
which
come
must
up
be frustrating for doctors too, right? Have people come in thinking this is what I've got, and you know, you're an instant medical expert.
Yes. So this is a real challenge at the moment for how we educate and train our healthcare professionals. You know, how do you manage the the individuals who come in with they've done all the reading and
they've convinced themselves
that they've got a particular form of condition when actually it may be something else. So you actually have to spend half of the consultation talking them back and just outlining. So we need to do a lot more in terms of in the education space about how we actually manage misinformation. And I think it all comes down to helping people communicate better. And it's about, you know, one of the things I keep thinking about is how do we start developing programs to raise general awareness, health literacy programs for the general population, for the general public and specific groups, because the more we can do in terms of raising people's literacy levels in terms of health, the better will be for all of us.
Professor Rachel Huxley is with the Executive Dean of the Faculty of Health at Deakin University, leading the involvement in the new centre, which is about to open a virtual centre for sex and gender equity in health and medicine. It's a collaboration between Deakin University, the George Institute of Global Health, and the Australian Human Rights Institute.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Michelle Hunt here with you in Melbourne. Bronwyn O'Shea joining you from ABC Wodonga, and Professor Rachel Huxley, the Executive Dean of the Faculty of Health from Deakin, is in the studio with you as well as we look at gender bias within the medical world. Maybe you've experienced it if you work in medicine, or as a patient, you've experienced some form of gender bias. When we talk about not being believed, endometriosis is probably the number one poster child when it comes to gender bias in the medical world. That is shifting and changing to the point now where not only are we discussing it, but we have incredible research and work being done, and even entire centres being open. Dr. Tarana Lucky is a gynaecologist and an endometriosis expert and researcher at the Julia Argyrou Endometriosis Centre at Epworth. It's been open for a couple of years now and specialises in endometriosis. Dr. Lucky, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour. We are making progress when it comes to endometriosis and women being believed, but it's been a big fight, hasn't it?
It's really, really such an important topic, and I really appraise that we are talking about it. it has got better, I must say. There's a little bit more advocacy, a little bit more awareness. But to be honest, there's so much more to do and such a long way to go still. But yes, we are getting some attention, but not enough, in my opinion, yet.
What sort of work is being done at the centre where you are in terms of making sure that women are not only heard but being treated as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy that you mentioned about being heard, because I think hearing and listening to the patient, I would say the mainstay of the treatment, right? You have to listen to the pain. You cannot normalise the pain. And this pain and endometriosis is never one size of treatment fits all. With such a good care coordination, that holistic approach to the patient. And that's where that center comes along. We are very lucky in Victoria that JC, in short form, or Julia Arguro Endometriosis Center, it's the center of excellence where we try to provide the coordinated care to the patient, particularly around increasing awareness, patient education, and also linking to all the different specialties that need to be involved in women's care.
How challenging is it for women, or anyone really, but today we're talking about women particularly, to continue to advocate for themselves? This isn't about endo, but there's a text here that says, I have GI issues and have had shocking treatment because of the assumption that if one is youngish, female and underweight, then you must have an eating disorder. And she says, I now live with PTSD because of the care I was subjected to. Over the years, I've spoken to dozens of women with similar health issues, and I'd be hard-pressed to name one who hasn't had a similar experience to myself, she says. Self-advocacy is a joke. If you speak up, you're labelled a problem patient and your care becomes worse.
So what do we say? Like, it's such a huge issue, isn't it? Like, being women, I think all of us at some point has experienced some bias, unconscious or conscious. But, you know, if we talk about particularly pain, for example, in context of endometriosis, along with other several health symptoms and conditions, often we are being dismissed because, say, for example, period pain or pain during your menstruation, so many women still come to me and would say that, oh, I thought it was normal. And my grandma, my mom, the doctor I went to said that it's normal period pain. This normalization, this dismissal is like in the core of underdiagnosis of endometriosis or, for example, any women's health condition. So I think self-advocacy is important, but we have to really spread that advocacy across multi-platform, like female, male health practitioner, politician. Like, it has to go through all platforms.
It comes back to Rachel as well. At the beginning of the program, you spoke about the communication, the language, almost reteaching and reframing what a consultation looks like. I mean, they're rushed. If we talk about sort of that very beginning, that process of a GP visit, we know how under pressure the profession is, and you think you've only got sort of 15 minutes and if you're lucky, and I mean everything about it from the very beginning kind of feels rushed, under pressure.
You start from a deficit model.
Yes. How do you change that communication?
I mean, you have just spoken my mind, because that's what exactly I've been hearing from my patients. Like, I just feel like, you know, I'm not listened to. I don't have enough time to speak about my symptoms. I would suggest, like many of us endometriosis experts, we actually always allow way more time than an allowed time for a non-chronic conditions. I think time is important. We should advocate more for a long consult. And not only in the specialist setting, it's also in the institute, because you can get so much clue around the pain from the history of the patient. This actually reminds me, like, you know, a quote that if you have to understand someone today, you have to start yesterday. So you have to listen to their story. And I think this advocacy is also important, like, you know, giving the patient enough time to tell about the symptoms, the trigger factors. Was there any influencer or risk factor that may have initiated the pain? Could be endometriosis, could be something else. Like, one lovely woman was talking about fibromyalgia, myalgia, like so many overlapping pain conditions. So you have
and
to
it can
have
take a while
consult.
To get a diagnosis. Yeah, Rachel?
Yes, I was actually reflecting back on where the switch was. When did endometriosis become such a hot topic of focus? And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think back to when Greg Hunt was the federal health minister, and he made a deliberate partition in some of the medical research funds that he had available to focus specifically on endometriosis. I believe a family member suffered from it. But it got me thinking, does it take to have a male voice to say, to give credibility to? I mean, I'm shocked by my own thought process there, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
I mean, see, this is like the unconsciously we are getting there, isn't it? But I mean, it should not be, to be honest. Like, in terms of timeline, if you ask me when it all started to make a little difference or, like, you know, getting more attention, I would say past one decade has been a good shift. But, you know, last few years or 5 years, there's more and more research funding coming along, getting more recognized at national level and state level. You know, I think we need to come out of that and having more, doesn't have to be female or male advocacy, just have to be like a strong advocacy and attention around this. Yeah.
I agree. And I think there's also an onus of responsibility on female leaders across all aspects of society who have an agency, who have a voice. They should be tackling the stigma that often prevents other women who aren't as fortunate in having a voice to actually say, this is an issue, I've got this. Let's have
We're
a conversation about it.
In the sporting world, we've seen a couple of incredible women, where there was a marathon runner who just had a period while she was in the middle of a marathon, who deliberately just bled, just went, you know what, I'm going to be running for 4 hours. This is just going to be life. We've had swimmers openly talk about having their period, and that has led to changes in how women train, the sort of work that's being done in
their
hormones.
Their outfits.
They don't have to wear white shorts anymore. So we are seeing some women stand up and take leadership there.
Sharing the story.
One of the big things that's come up in this conversation is time and listening. And there's a few texts saying, well, this one says a long GP consult is $120 or more, $160 in some practices. That's part of the problem. Another here says actually 15 minutes is probably ample time if the doctor can listen, but too often they hear a couple of symptoms and assume they know the answer, shut down the patient. I'm wondering if we need to, you know, rethink just the structure or the flexibility around when you go and see a healthcare professional, and how do you kind of build a system that has that flex.
I agree, and I think the other challenge we have is the lack of continuity of care. You know, I'm from the UK, and it's very rare that you will see the same GP on a regular visit. So it's almost like you have to start.
Almost here now.
Yeah, you have to start back from the beginning each time, and it's incredibly frustrating. So having a preferred health provider, continuity of care, is together with health literacy.
I just want to bring Jackie into this, who's in Eagle Point, because I'm fascinated as to what you're going to tell us, Jackie. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. My husband is an engineer, and only a few years ago, within 10 years, he read out to me this article that was in one of his engineering magazines, where they had carried out an investigation because men had been receiving a better recovery after their hip replacements, but women weren't. And when they did this investigation, they found out that women were being fitted with men's hip replacements.
So you already knew that happened. Yeah.
Well, we don't have female-specific prosthetics.
We don't
Why?
Have...
Why?
Sorry?
Well, they're not commonly used. So all
Why
the
not?
Knee and hip.
That's... When we talk about progress...
Yeah.
I mean, a woman should not be fitted with a
but
male
But how
hip.
Did we get here? Is it because it's more expensive to have two versions of everything? The same with the research on the male mice or whatever it is. Is it just... Does it all come down to cost?
I think that's a... too easy an answer. Cost is undoubtedly up there. If you're doing the whole design process, you almost need to have a duplicate design process if you're looking at it from a gendered lens. But again, I think it comes back to empathy actually, when you're thinking about how you look through somebody else's eyes, and the comment one of the earlier listeners was making about education really needs to start in the home. How do we bring up our children to be cognizant of sex and gender differences? And I'm very aware of that. I've got a boy and a girl, and I try very hard to get them to see things from different perspectives, but it's very hard.
Well, the fact that we've just learned at the end of the program that women are being fitted with male hips is just shows you still how far we've got to go. Dr. Tarana Lucky, thank you so much for your time, gynecologist and endometriosis expert and researcher at the Julia Argyrou Endometriosis Centre. Just finally, Professor Rachel Huxley, this new centre, this virtual centre, it's due to open next week. Who can access it, and how can people access it? We go on and put in symptoms. Is it for professionals? Is it for patients? How will it work?
Anybody can access it. In fact, the more the better. We are in our early days, and you made a comment about private money. It is private. It's based, it's philanthropic funding at the moment. We are trying to gain funding from our health departments to support the work of the centre, because I think, as the conversation this morning has highlighted, there is a critical need. We need to increase the level of awareness and options and the voice and give rise to these issues.
What I find incredible is that there are people and philanthropists as well that are out there that are making sure that this work gets done while we wait for government to catch up and realise that they have a role to play in this. We wish you all the best. Do you know roughly when it goes live next week? I don't want to jinx it, by the way.
It's going to crash.
28th of March.
Fantastic. It's called the Centre for Sex and Gender Equity in Health and Medicine. As we said, it's a collaboration between Deakin University, the George Institute of Global Health, and the Australian Human Rights Institute. Professor Rachel Huxley, Executive Dean for the Faculty of Health at Deakin, thank you so much for your time this morning and for all of the work that you do in this area. I reckon we should touch base in about 6 months' time and see some of the work that's come out of it and some of the progression that's made. It'd be great to speak
with
you.
That would be fantastic. Thanks again, Rochelle and Bronwyn. Much appreciated.
And we've done heaps of shows, Bron, on everything from hidden pain, endometriosis. So the Conversation Hour is a podcast. You can go back through our feeds. You can subscribe to the Conversation Hour. You can share today's episode, or you can listen back to another topic. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.